Terrorists and the threats posed by international terrorism may not respect borders, but legal systems do. So we thought it might be a good idea to compare how terrorism trials are conducted around the world, from the United States to the European Union, Russia, and Pakistan. And joining us now is Kim Shepley, a visiting professor at Yale Law School this year and director of the program in law and public affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. I'm very pleased it brings her to our show today. Hello.
Hi, lovely to be here.
The most high-profile and controversial terrorism trial in the United States at the moment is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's. First, he was supposed to be tried in civilian courts. Now it looks likely he'll go before a military commission. Why has this issue become such a political hot potato?
Well, we actually don't know where he's going to wind up eventually, but the reason why it's become a political hot potato is because of the public reaction to having his trial be held right near Ground Zero in New York City. The odd thing about this case is that I think many people, certainly on the legal side of this, thought that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed would be a perfect candidate for a federal trial in New York City because so much of the evidence against him is completely untainted by things the U.S. has done since 9/11. And yet the public reaction really has caused the Obama administration at least to pause and think about what should be done with him. And while the decision has not yet been made to send him to a military commission, that's clearly one of the options they're considering.
Well, one of the arguments is that a civilian trial for terrorist suspects like Khalil Sheikh Mohammed give them a platform for expressing their hateful views or force the government to reveal sensitive intelligence information. But you're saying in his case there isn't all that much sensitive intelligence information that they might be forced to reveal?
Well, I think they can certainly make the case without actually revealing sensitive foreign intelligence information. And my guess is that they clearly evaluated that before they made the decision to bring him to New York City. I mean, among the bits of evidence against KSM, as he's called in the trade, is that he actually confessed to the 9/11 bombings on Al Jazeera. So we have him in his own words saying that he actually planned and plotted this particular attack. With evidence like that, you don't need a lot of secret intelligence information from foreign sources.
We can't say, well, the confession was coerced when it was on Al Jazeera.
Exactly.
Last month, Scott Shane and Charlie Savage reported in the New York Times that, I'm quoting, many counterterrorism officials think there are pragmatic advantages of keeping both civilian and military trials available. In which kinds of cases would it be more pragmatic for the U.S. to use a military commission over a civilian trial?
Well, there's a clear role for military commissions if you're talking about an actual shooting war. And insofar as some of these folks, for example, in Guantanamo, have been picked up on essentially law of war charges, they've committed violations of the law of war. In those kinds of cases, it's not at all unusual to use military commissions, or rather courts martial. That's a little different than the military commissions that we have set up in Guantanamo. So for clear cases that are violations of the law of war, I don't think most lawyers or scholars have trouble with those kinds of cases going before courts martial. The problem, actually, in the American context is that the U.S. has a long history of trying terrorists in U.S. federal courts, and the U.S. has had a long and successful history trying terrorists in federal courts. The problem is that I think we've gone a little bit weak in the knees on that question since 9/11, in part because a lot of the folks that we're now thinking about bringing to trial in U.S. courts have either been made out to be extremely dangerous or the U.S. has mistreated them so badly we're afraid the trials are going to misfire. But typically the division is, for someone who's committed an offense against U.S. law, you try them in U.S. court. For someone who's committed an offense against the law of war and they're jurisdictionally suitable for a military commission, or rather a courts martial, you try them in military court. The problem here is categorizing people one way or the other.
Well, last week the Justice Department announced it successfully convicted 400 people in international terrorism and terror-related civilian trials since September 11th. Mm-hmm. And that's a much higher conviction rate than in non-terrorism-related crimes, isn't it?
Well, exactly. I mean, the military commissions have not exactly had a high conviction rate, or for that matter, a high rate of actually getting started on any of these cases. Moreover, with military commissions, we don't even know if those judgments are going to hold up when they're actually scrutinized by the U.S. Supreme Court. That said, there's been this astonishing track record, which most people don't know, of how many cases have been tried in U.S. Federal court and how many convictions there are. There was a study done by Human Rights First of more than almost 300 defendants charged with terrorism-related offenses and tried in U.S. courts, and the conviction rate was 91.12%. So these are cases that have been able to be successfully made without bending any of the rules of civilian trials, without disclosing classified information to inappropriate folks. And so these cases really have a terrific track record, particularly in the Southern District of New York, right there in Manhattan, where a lot of the really high-profile trials were held during the 1990s.
So I would have thought that people who wanted to see KSM sent away to jail would have preferred a civilian trial.
Well, you'd think if they want the certainty of the conviction that they would prefer civilian trials, because we know how those work. The rules are tried and tested. I think the evidence in this case is really not a problem. Justice would not only be done, but would be seen to being done, which I think is a crucial thing, not only at home, but also abroad. I just didn't see this as really a high-risk strategy for the government to use, and it's something that really has been in accordance with what the U.S. government has done from the Clinton administration through the Bush administration until now.
My guest is Kim Lane Shepley, and she's at Princeton University, but currently a visiting professor at Yale Law School. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, how hard is it to prosecute a terrorism case if we have such a high conviction rate? Why is it that in some cases terrorists get convicted on things like wire fraud or other kinds of crimes?
Right. Well, the U.S. government typically will put together the case it thinks it can win. And there are certain kinds of terrorism charges that are very easy to prove, other ones that are much more difficult to prove. And so a prosecutor, when trying to figure out how to put up a case, will look for those charges that he or she believes can actually be made out. Now, it turns out if terrorism is difficult to prove, either because the evidence is a little bit shaky or because actually making out the case requires disclosing classified information or information from foreign intelligence sources, then what the U.S. government will do is go for wire fraud or for narcotics offenses, actually, is a current favorite. So the idea is to put those guys away and for some law they have violated. And even if the U.S. has an interest in them primarily for terrorism reasons, they may actually charge them with something else. That said, there is one crime that I know your show has done some work on, and that is that there's an offense put onto the law books actually in the Clinton days and expanded with the USA Patriot Act, and it's the charge of material support for terrorism. Now, this is a crime in U.S. law that consists of proving that the defendant in question has provided material support, and material support can be anything ranging from a stay for the night through to money contributions, through even perhaps to legal advice, anything that looks like support to an organization that's been designated by the U.S. as a foreign terrorist organization or a specially designated terrorist organization. And this turns out to be pretty easy to prove because it turns out if a defendant says, well, wait a second, the organization to which I gave money is not really a terrorism outfit. I didn't certainly give money to terrorists deliberately. The U.S. government can come back and say, well, we've designated that organization a terrorist organization. You can't actually challenge that as part of the criminal prosecution. So the only question, the only thing the government typically has to prove in those cases is that the support was actually given. So those are cases that it's usually quite easy for the government to win. Now, the only dilemma with that particular charge in the case of, for example, some of the Guantanamo detainees who might well be found guilty of such an offense is that that particular crime in U.S. law has a 7-year statute of limitations. And a lot of the Guantanamo detainees were picked up in 2001 and 2002. And you can do the arithmetic. When President Obama comes into office in 2009, wanting to set all these things right and put things on a legal track, material support for terrorism doesn't look like the kind of charge you can bring in a U.S. federal court.
So his hands are tied.
So his hands are tied, and I think that's one of the reasons why the Obama administration, against all expectations, started looking again at the military commission option.
What about the whole problem of defining just what terrorism is?
Oh.
You know, I mean, we have those people who say one man's terrorist is the next man's freedom fighter.
Oh, this is really a big problem. It's a big problem in U.S. law, and it's an even bigger problem seen internationally. So in U.S. law, depending on what part of U.S. law you look at, there are upwards of 24 different definitions of terrorism in different parts of U.S. law. In the part that actually is the criminal offense of terrorism, of international or domestic terrorism, the definition is a little problematic because the person who is charged with terrorism is deemed to be someone who has committed a series of violent acts, and this is the crucial part of the statute, these acts have been committed in such a way that, and this is the literal wording of the statute, they appear to be intended to put terror in the minds of the public or to get the government to change its mind about something. But the appear to be intended to is just a very odd feature. There's no other crime in federal law that has, that in a sense puts the mens rea of the offense, the guilty mind, in the mind of the prosecutor, right? It's whether the prosecutor thinks this thing looks like it was intended to terrorize the public or try to get the government to change its mind about something. And that leaves a lot of discretion for prosecutors in U.S. law. This gets even messier when you look abroad, because right after 9/11, when the world was still quite sympathetic to the U.S. position and was really believing that the U.S. had been unfairly victimized, the U.N. Security Council passed a resolution that requires every country in the world to criminalize something called terrorism. It's actually a requirement of international law now that every state have an anti-terrorism law. The problem is that there is no agreed-upon international definition of terrorism in international law. So states are given this mandate, and then they're told, okay, so you make it up. So what you find is, as you look around the world, are a huge variety of things defined as terrorism. And not surprisingly, what you get is a little bit what you might expect from the governments under consideration, my personal favorite being the law that Vietnam passed after 2001, Vietnam not known for its highly democratic sensibility, shall we say. Vietnam defines terrorism as, quote, anything that disrupts the people's order, unquote. Yeah.
Now, what about in the European Union? Do they have a fairly consistent definition of terrorism?
Yes. Well, after 9/11, the European Union decided to try to act to coordinate European policy on terrorism. And the European Union passed what was called a framework decision on terrorism, which proposes a definition of terrorism that is not too bad. What it says is terrorism is something that consists of committing an action that would count as terrorism under one of 12 different international charters and international treaties, and then says any act of violence to people or property, and then it says that actually causes terror in the public mind, gets the government to change its mind, and so forth. So that definition is now an EU definition. It's been adopted with some variation by different states of the European Union. But a lot of states go beyond the European Union definition. So one of my favorites is actually France, which enacted a new crime in 2002 that in their reports to the United Nations they translate as pimping for terrorism. That's their words, not mine. And what does that crime consist of? Well, it consists of having large amounts of unexplained cash while the government believes that some of your friends are terrorists.
And that's, they use the word pimping?
They use the word pimping for terrorism is how they translate it to the UN. But think about this. I mean, so you don't know necessarily that the government believes that all of your friends are terrorists. Suppose you just came by some cash, either through an inheritance or somebody's lending you money or something of that kind. Given the transparency of banking transactions, which is another post 9/11 feature of this global legal order, it turns out the government can sort of show up on your doorstep and say, so why do you have all this cash? And this can be a criminal offense to not explain where the cash is from, or to not explain satisfactorily that it's from some source other than terrorist activity.
Don't we all have a certain amount of slippery slope attitude here? For example, Many Americans will tell you that the Uyghurs are not terrorists, but the Chinese government will say they are.
Mm-hmm.
People who are sympathetic to the Chechen cause may not be sympathetic to blowing up train stations and the like, but still might mm-hmm. see their activities as growing out of just a desire for independence. How do we even work these things out internationally?
Well, I'll tell you, this is, you know, if there were international agreement on this, the war on terror, so to speak, would be a much less dangerous thing for civil liberties around the world. There clearly are groups that have in their sights particular governments and particular policies. And then there are other kinds of groups that have a much more sort of global set of targets. Because there is no international agreement on terrorism, there is also no international agreement on which groups get to count as international terrorists. Okay, now, that said, the campaign that's being waged against terrorism by the UN Security Council, which is a fairly substantial effort, is pretty well limited to Al-Qaeda and Taliban, not because it has to be necessarily, but because you can't actually get agreement on the Security Council to add other groups. But that said, most countries have their own sort of terrorism hit lists, as it were. And the U.S. government has clearly added groups and individuals to its terrorism hit list as a way of getting the support of countries that they want to have on board in the U.S.'s own global anti-terror campaign. So, for example, the Uyghurs, who were challenging the Chinese government, were considered freedom fighters by the U.S. Congress throughout the 1990s. Multiple resolutions passed by Congress talking about the way in which the Chinese government repressed religious minorities, and the Uyghurs were sort of the darlings of the U.S. Congress. But China turns out to be one of the five blocking vetoes on the UN Security Council. And if the U.S. wanted to conduct its anti-terror campaign using the Security Council as a kind of hammer to hit states over the head with, it needed China's support for that campaign. So what happened? Well, on the eve of the UN vote on September 28, 2001, suddenly the U.S. lists all the Uyghur groups on its own watch list of terrorists. And so suddenly their terrorists became our terrorists, and it was a giant, this is just the timing is otherwise suspicious, but it looked like the U.S. was trying to get China's vote at the U.N.
Did it work?
Oh, yeah. China's been completely on board with the anti-terror campaign. In fact, it's really quite remarkable to see how active the Security Council has been in passing a series of resolutions that do something that no other Security Council resolution has ever before done, and that is to pass resolutions under what's called technically its Chapter 7 powers under the UN Charter, which means that the Security Council resolution is binding on every single member state of the UN. And this series of resolutions, starting right after 9/11, requires states to change their domestic laws to be in compliance with the Security Council resolutions on pain of sanctions. Now, no sanctions have issued, but the Security Council has really been monitoring what states have done. And some of the resolutions are actually quite remarkable. There's a 2004 resolution, for example, that requires states to criminalize incitement to terrorism. Okay, now you can imagine even the U.S. would have some trouble with that under its own First Amendment. But Britain then passed a law that criminalizes what's called in the British law the glorification of terrorism. You begin to wonder how broadly that reaches. And then you get a country like Russia, for example, which doesn't have, shall we say, very deep traditions of free speech, that eagerly jumps on board and criminalizes incitement to terrorism in ways that sweeps in a lot of what the Russian opposition thought of as its criticism of the Russian campaign in the Caucasus in Chechnya and surrounds. But countries are doing this. I mean, so the Russian government, the British government, when they're criticized by their own domestic human rights folks, say, well, this isn't our idea. We have to do it because the Security Council is making us do it. And it also means that when all these countries' courts get these laws, when they're challenged under their own domestic constitutions, the courts are in a bit of a bind because the courts have law on one side and law on the other side. The requirement to uphold the UN Charter, and the requirement to engage in free speech. So not surprisingly, a lot of courts have not really been striking down these laws precisely because international law is on one side and domestic constitutional law is on the other.
I'm talking with Kim Lane Shepley, a visiting professor at Yale Law School this year and director of the program in Law and Public Affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Kim Lane Shepley, a visiting professor at Yale Law School and a director of the program in Law and Public Affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. Last week, there were reports that the Obama administration is considering using the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan for long-term detainees captured elsewhere. Is there any particular reason to move a terror suspect that was captured elsewhere into a war zone like Afghanistan?
Well, I think the Obama administration is trying to struggle with how to detain people that it doesn't necessarily feel are ready to bring to trial. And since Guantanamo is now under the supervision of the U.S. courts, Bagram began to look like a place that the U.S. government could stash detainees in and be removed from the reach of U.S. courts. But all of that has been changing. There's a case that's working its way through the U.S. courts. It's called the Makala case. And it's a case of a detainee in Bagram who was captured outside of Afghanistan, moved there. Actually, there's a set of detainees that were in that situation. And they filed a petition for a writ of habeas corpus from the district court in Washington, which is to say they wanted the government to have to provide evidence to a U.S. judge about why they were being detained. And the trial judge actually said, well, wait a second, this is not a situation very much different from Guantanamo, because at Bagram Air Base, the U.S. actually does have full control over the air base, and they moved people into there. So this was something that the U.S. government did at its discretion. So therefore, the U.S. court should have to review those detentions. And that case was just argued before the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeal, and we're awaiting the judgment. But if that case, if on appeal that case goes the way the trial judge ruled, then there may actually be habeas cases coming out of Bagram.
So a detainee sent from Guantanamo to Bagram would have the same rights as a detainee sent from Guantanamo to the prison in Thompson, Illinois, which the administration is considering using to hold terror suspects?
Well, they might. Depending on how the Court of Appeals rules, they very well might. So it could be, I mean, one of the things the Obama administration is clearly wrestling with is what to do if they pick up somebody somewhere in the world that they suspect is a terrorist and they want to hold them without actually having to put them on trial someplace. And the question is where to keep them. Now, you know, one option was Guantanamo. That's been foreclosed, at least if the government wants to evade American judicial review. The next option was Bagram. The courts are closing in on Bagram. And so the question is then, where are detainees kept? I mean, some of us have argued the government ought to at least have some evidentiary showing, be able to say, so why are they holding these folks? That's all a habeas hearing entitles you to. It doesn't mean you get freed. It means the government has to say why they're holding you. A lot of us think that's a good thing. But what I suspect has also been going on is that the U.S. works with a lot of its allies, many of whom have detention laws that are far more capacious than those in the United States. And you could imagine the U.S. government deciding to hand a detainee off to another country for safekeeping or perhaps not safekeeping, as the case may be.
Well, has the United States helped shape how terrorism trials are conducted in Iraq and Afghanistan as the occupying power of both of those countries?
Well, yeah, absolutely. So actually, the Afghan case is a particularly interesting one. The vast majority of the detainees who were held at the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan are actually Afghan detainees. And the U.S. has been trying to figure out, so what do we do with them? They wanted to offload some of these detainees once they decided they were no longer dangerous. But they wanted to offload them in such a way that they weren't immediately let go into the fighting. So what the U.S. government then started to do was to collect up little dossiers on a lot of the detainees that they were holding at Bagram Air Base. And then they would release the detainee into the custody of Afghan officials and to Afghan prosecutors and hand off with the detainee a little dossier full of evidence against the detainee. Now, this is all evidence collected by the U.S. military. Some of it may come from, for example, other detainees who have been questioned in less than consensual circumstances. In fact, we suspect a lot of the evidence actually looks like that. This is all evidence collected in some ways by someone who has, or by a government that has every interest in keeping these guys detained. So the U.S. hands off the detainee, hands off the dossier, and the Afghan criminal justice system, which is impoverished and really a mess, then takes the dossier and turns it over to a judge who announces the conviction of that person in Afghan law. So it looks like a purely domestic legal proceeding. The person is released from Bagram, released from U.S. custody, turned over to Afghan prosecutors that conduct something like a trial, and then the person is convicted under Afghan law and then held in these dreadful Afghan prisons. But it turns out that all of the evidence presented at trial was collected by the U.S.
Five U.S. citizens are currently on trial in Pakistan on terrorism charges. They're being tried before one of Pakistan's anti-terrorism courts.
Mm-hmm.
And what are they being charged with?
Well, they're being charged with terrorism and a whole range of other offenses. In fact, what's interesting about the Pakistani anti-terrorism courts is that there's been a decade-long war between the executive branch in Pakistan, the president and his assistants, and the judiciary in Pakistan, particularly the Pakistani Supreme Court, over the constitutionality of these anti-terrorism courts. So 10, 12 years ago, the Supreme Court declared that these anti-terrorism courts were unconstitutional because they were military courts. So the government came back and now has civilian judges. The Supreme Court declared those unconstitutional again because the criminal procedure protections given in those trials were not the same. So now the courts have been reconstituted again with more or less the same rules of evidence and procedure with civilian judges. But the trials are all on a fast track. As you can see, the Americans were arrested in February. They already had a hearing. The case is probably going to go to trial later this month. This is really a fast track for Pakistani courts. And because the Pakistani Supreme Court is worried about the due process given to anyone who goes through these courts, last summer the Pakistani Supreme Court announced that it was going to personally take charge of all of these cases and review them all at its own discretion. So even though those trials may well look like they're sort of rammed through proceedings, the Pakistani Supreme Court has been astonishingly brave and astonishingly good at trying to keep Pakistan's campaign against terrorism on a legal track.
Well, the five Americans allege that they've been tortured while they're in jail to collect evidence. Would that play out in the same way in Pakistan as it would in an American court?
Well, yes, it would. I mean, now the question is, I mean, people all the time claim they've been tortured in detention. Many people who have been held in Pakistan claim to have been tortured in detention, and often with good reason. The question is how it is you actually prove in a court that you've been tortured and whether a judge actually hears that evidence. And here's where actually Pakistan has rules that are a bit like the U.S. Both Pakistan and the U.S. are descendants of the English common law, as it were, and inherit many of the same rules, in which evidence acquired by torture, a confession acquired by torture, is clearly inadmissible. This is clearly a problem. But it gets a little fuzzier when it comes to what I call third-party torture. Okay, so suppose you've got someone called Joe on trial, and the government tortures Sam to get information about Joe. Okay, we know the government can't torture Joe and introduce his confession, at least not if that information comes out. But can they torture Sam to get information against Joe? Well, you know, in all of our common law systems, the only way we prevent evidence like that from coming in is through our rather arcane rules of hearsay. The idea is if somebody makes a statement out of court, you know, Sam's tortured, he says something about Joe, then he has to come into court and repeat it in order for that statement to count as evidence against Joe. And the reason why he has to come in is because you want to see that he's making the statement voluntarily, you want to cross-examine him on it, all those kinds of reasons. But oftentimes in anti-terror proceedings, and this is actually true also of the military commissions in Guantanamo, the barriers to admitting hearsay are lowered. And so what does that do? Well, it starts to allow statements by the Sams of the world who have been tortured for information against Joe to start having their statements come in court against Joe. And so that's the thing, it's that kind of sideways torture that I think we have to worry about in a lot of those proceedings. In fact, there's even been a U.S. court where that kind of sideways torture came in the Massawi case. Massawi's lawyers had asked for testimony from none other than Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, whom we were talking about earlier. Of course, the U.S. government refused to let Khalid Sheikh Mohammed testify, and after a lot of legal wrangling, the agreement that was reached was that redacted summaries of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's interrogations, and remember, he's the guy who's been waterboarded, you know, more than 150 times, his evidence came in the trial against Zacharias Massawi, even though he had clearly been tortured. And nobody on either side mentioned the torture. So that kind of third-party torture is coming in cases all over the world. There have been cases in Germany, in Spain, in the UK. Now there's a question about these Pakistani cases in the U.S. It's not so much the direct confessions you got to be worried about. I mean, yes, those too, but most countries know how to avoid those. It's this third-party torture issue that really is the at the front lines of evidence in all these torture trials.
And then there's just straightforward torture. Human Rights Watch's 2010 World Report says that in Russia, counterterrorism operations in the North Caucasus continue to involve grave human rights violations such as torture, unforced disappearances, and extrajudicial execution, and that doesn't even mention allegations that the Russian government targets journalists and other legitimate political opposition leaders.
Yeah, well, this is, I actually do a lot of work in Russia. I spend a lot of time there every year, and here I think you've got actually a fairly mixed picture, because the Russian government brought in a new criminal procedure code in 2003, and they're putting a huge amount of effort into, in ordinary cases, training the police not to try to acquire confessions through torture. They're having some trouble with this. I had a very well-known Russian judge take me aside at a conference a few years ago and say to me, the American, you know, who grew up in the Cold War, can you please tell your government to stop torturing people, because we're having a lot of trouble trying to convince the Russian police that this isn't a legitimate strategy of criminal investigation. So at the highest levels in Russia, they're trying to stamp out torture and forced confessions in the ordinary policing. Now, that said, the North Caucasus are always different, and there have been well-documented cases, partly because you're dealing with interior ministry police rather than the militia, the ordinary police, and they're sort of fighting something like an anti-terror campaign that looks like a war, and they are really using brutal tactics. That's certainly the case. That said, the one time that Russia's ever captured a terrorist, there was one terrorist, alleged terrorist, who escaped from the school siege in Beslan. They actually put that guy on trial in an ordinary Russian court before an ordinary Russian judge. It was a public trial. And he was convicted.
Ah. Well, I want to thank you so much for telling us about what's happening all around the world. It's been fascinating. Kim Lane Shepley is the director of the program in law and public affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, currently a visiting professor at Yale Law School. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Lovely being here. Thanks much.